Hello, this is Steven, speaking to you from February 22nd, 2024. This episode was originally recorded on May 9th, 2020. That is something that you know now. Congratulations! Hello, and welcome to
SF3.
Yes, SF3, the podcast formerly known as Sci-Fi. Podcast about science fiction and fantasy audiobooks. Hosted by three men, all of whom are corpses puppeted by eldritch means, because technically that's what life is.
Yay.
I am a meat popsicle.
Meat puppet, go.
Say that. I nearly scripted that. Each episode, we start with a summary, then give a brief review, then take a break before going to our spoiler section, where all of the audiobook's unspeakable secrets may be revealed.
Necro something.
Today we are looking at Gideon the Ninth, 2019, written by Tamsin Muir and narrated by Moira Quirk. And since this was more or less my choice, I am giving the reading from the back of the book.
What's it say?
Who knows? First, we have the short and dubiously accurate but awesome zinger by Charlie Strauss. Lesbian necromancers explore a haunted castle in space.
Yes, in space.
But from the back of the book, the Emperor needs necromancers. The Ninth Necromancer needs a swordswoman. Gideon has a sword, some dirty magazines, and no time for undead nonsense. Brought up by unfriendly ossifying nuns, ancient retainers, and countless skeletons, Gideon is ready to abandon a life of servitude and an afterlife as a reanimated corpse. She packs up her sword, her shoes, and her dirty magazines, and prepares to launch her daring escape. But her childhood nemesis won't set her free without a service. Harrowhark Nonagesimus, Reverend Daughter of the Ninth House and Bone Witch Extraordinaire, has been summoned into action. The Emperor has invited the heirs to each of his loyal houses to a deadly trial of wits and skill. If Harrowhark succeeds, she will become an immortal, all-powerful servant of the Resurrection. But no necromancer can ascend without their cavalier. Without Gideon's sword, Harrow will fail and the Ninth House will die. Of course, some things are better left dead.
Or undead.
That begs the question, then, is if they're already dead, how will they die?
There's that whole Necronomicon thingy about, you know, that cannot die, which lies whatever it is.
Good job.
I mean, that's a direct quote. It's been fixed in most of the copies, but...
Yes.
What is it?
What did everybody think? Kevin, give us your in-depth analysis.
In depth, indeed. I will say by the end, it was amusing. It took about a third of the book to get into it for me, or at least however long it took for them to get to the other planet. So, I think my review is if you can hold out to that point, then you'll be amused by it. Yes. I would have condensed that entire section into a couple pages and then jumped right in.
One sentence, and then some stuff happened. Now the haunted castle in space.
Exactly. In fact, I think they should rename the entire series to Haunted Castle in Space.
Well, I mean, the sentiment that Charlie Strauss was expressing is absolutely correct, but as far as I know, our lead necromancer never expresses her sexuality very directly. And the castle is on a planet, which, I mean, the planet's in space, but, I mean, in that case, we are also in space.
Are there any planets that are not in space?
I don't know.
This requires more investigation.
Absolutely. And while you're doing that, what did you think of this book?
I liked it. I actually really enjoyed the intro to the book. It really...
So the part that Kevin wants to compress down to three words.
Yeah, I think so. It really got me hooked, you know, and the whole book, it's very fast-paced. At least that's what I felt. I felt it was like a lot like, well, since we listen to audiobooks, it felt like listening to Mad Max Fury Road.
Yeah, it does have that kind of crazed feel to it. I did enjoy that, yes. I also thought it was great. My take on it is that we have a really sort of strong main character who's a complete smartass. I could imagine some people really hating her. but she grew on me very quickly because she's a smartass. She's a super swordswoman. She's, you know, got some kinds of powers or things that aren't fully explained, and she's got a mysterious origin. And yet she's not perfect. She's definitely got flaws. She doesn't seem to think much further than walking out of the room or something. You know, she's not a very strategic thinker. She is definitely not somebody that can control her emotions very well. And there's definitely a contrast between how she talks and how everybody else in the book seems to talk, because everyone else seems to speak in a certain more formal register, and she mostly just talks like somebody reading a Facebook comment or something like that, like a very bratty Twitter account of some kind. But I thought she was fantastic, and I really like the sort of almost satire of Lovecraft going on while this story is being played relatively straight. The pacing worked. Although there's plenty left for the rest of the series, I think that they stuck the landing reasonably well. So, well done. Also, I thought that our narrator, Moira Quirk, did a fantastic job just throwing herself into every single line, chewing scenery where appropriate, made excellent voice choices. Well, I believe it is time for us to seal the tomb of our review section and unseal the crypt that is our discussion section. We shall return, for we are S.
F.
3.
So welcome back to our discussion section, where we will open the forbidden sealed tomb of all the spoilers in this book.
Huzzah.
The first point that I want to discuss was the character of Gideon, who I found sort of really fun, but I could see a lot of people finding her really annoying because she has essentially attitude all the time. What did you guys think of her, and what sent her one direction or the other?
I thought she was a fun character. I mean, you know, she does have a lot of attitude, and she does express herself regularly in words that I enjoy listening to, so...
Yes. The way that I kind of saw her was like, and this is a particular trope that I seem to enjoy a lot more than I would have expected, is the normal person set down in a Lovecraft style universe. She's trying to get out of a gothic mansion, so she tries to bribe her way out with pornography. And some people love it. I imagine Lovecraft himself would just find this incredibly annoying, which is probably a positive.
Yeah. Definitely not proper enough for him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as in also properly not racist as well.
Exactly. Kevin, did you have any problems with Gideon?
I like Gideon. I will say that it's definitely like you were saying, it's one of those things that sometimes getting into the tone of a new book can be a challenge if you're not in the mood for it, or if it's like a sudden abrupt change from a serious tone. This is not,
right.
You know, a serious tone really. So
yes. The last book we read was very serious, and so there was a bit of a slam.
Once you realize it's like, it's D&D with swearing and like, you know, snide comments or whatever you want to call it. I mean, the weirdest thing at first was kind of realizing that it wasn't fantasy, that it was space fantasy or whatever.
Oh, yes. Actually, I did want to talk about this because normally I think a lot about genre. In terms of, you know, figuring out, well, what were the expectations of this book? You know, did it meet those expectations? And this is a book that seemed to be taking the concept of genre and gleefully hacking it to death. You know, it's a mystery, it's science fiction, it's fantasy, it's a comedy, it even verges into romantic comedy at a couple of points. And normally that sort of thing gives me at least a good sense of confusion, if not whiplash. And I don't know, since there was the countervailing feeling of comedy, that didn't bother me. In fact, I really enjoyed sort of the, oh, you think it's this genre? Well, let's try this routine.
Yeah, that didn't bother me as much as I thought it might, but the humor bits lended a lot of levity to the other parts of the content about what was really going on, and things like killing 199 children to get something done.
Yes, that was the uplifting section.
There was definitely a lot of, I can't really call it mood whiplash, but definitely a huge range of moods happening all over the place. And one of the things that I found sort of interesting was the Gideon and Harrow relationship. because at first they basically just said, "I fucking hate you," straight out to each other in the beginning.
Well, that is kind of the trope for, well, that means it has to be the opposite by the end.
Right. And it kind of turned into that, but it didn't turn into like a strong romantic relationship, as far as I could tell. It turned into like this tremendous loyalty thing going on. But also, like, in the middle where, say, Hera is trying to be nice to Gideon and Gideon is literally freaking out, just like, no, honestly, you're making it weird. Stop that. This, of course, is based in kind of a Lovecraftian universe, you know, tombs everywhere, overall feeling of decay.
I didn't get that, oddly enough. It didn't feel Lovecraftian to me. Well, I think the first thing that jumped to my mind was, you know, the ancillary justice and Lecky stuff for some reason, probably because when they were starting to do space stuff and I was like, oh, it's kind of like goth space stuff that sort of like that, but it doesn't really fit that either.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of, I guess I didn't quite get the Lovecraft reference as well. I mean, it's kind of a Lovecraft setting, but without the Cthulhu and things sure. like that. I mean, I would think that this sort of reminds me of like a trio of movies. I don't know what the third one is, but the first two are probably like Cabin in the Woods and maybe like Hellraiser or something.
Sure.
But there's a third one in there I can't quite put my finger on. Maybe it's like How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days or something.
When Gideon met Hera.
Yes, there's also a certain number of elements of, you know, things like Dune and other big space operas going on because of the house genre.
Right. There's a lot of structure going on with these different houses and their different strengths. And it's kind of an evil Harry Potter in some ways.
That's what it is. That's the third one, Harry Potter.
Because they're sort of locked in this place where they're supposed to solve all of these puzzles and figure out how to become lictors. And lictors is, not fully described very well in the beginning, just like they would become immortal and all kinds of awesome stuff would happen. In the end, they discover that being a lictor is essentially learning how to grab somebody else's soul and their strengths and merge them into you so that you never actually have to die. You have the strength of a cavalier and the powers of a necromancer, I think was the overall idea.
Is this like dual classing in D&D?
Yeah, exactly. I honestly think so, yeah. So we have listed on our notes Chekhov's Dirty Magazine. So, I mean, yep. We've always assumed that Chekhov had something stored in that navigation console.
He did. It was circuits.
Yes, but that's actually a porn magazine for robots.
All my circuits?
Exactly.
All right. I put that in there. So very early on, you know, Gideon's, you know, sort of running away from home and, you know, with all of her dirty magazines. And then, you know, she trades them away. And I was like, well, when is she going to get them back? Right? It was brought up so early on that I felt like it had to, like, you know, make a reappearance.
Oh, that's what you mean.
Yes.
That Chekhov.
Yes, that Chekhov. Yes.
Did she actually trade them away?
Didn't she, or she had to ditch them or something? I can't remember.
She made up a title that apparently didn't actually exist, she confessed later. But I don't remember her actually giving them to anyone, so I could be wrong.
Yeah, they never made a reappearance, so maybe you wonder what was going on there. Maybe it's in book two.
So in the end, they mentioned that they didn't find Gideon's body, but they didn't mention also if they found her dirty magazines.
That was the most important part.
Right.
I mean, there were no ashes of the magazine.
Right. I mean, can you really say that you've really wrapped up the plot line if you haven't really figured out exactly what happened to her collection of rather randomly described pornography?
Yeah. What was it, like lesbian warriors of, you know, go crazy?
Something like that.
Were they just like pictures of skeletons or something? Like,
yeah.
Okay. Well, that was great. Well,
as far as the not wrapping stuff up, it was the part when they basically gassed all the 200 kids of their house to make sure that Harrow came out a necromancer and then Gideon survives and then they freak out over it. And then that was sort of like dropped on the table. And you know, right. Like, are they waiting for book two, I guess, or something? Because Sometimes yes. I have mixed feelings about that kind of thing, because part of me is like, okay, I don't have to have every single plot line wrapped up by the end of the book, but it seemed like such an obvious thing that they just sort of totally ignore after that. That,
well, you know, I don't mind that sort of wider character building needing to be fleshed out later on. I would have really hated it if they just hadn't bothered to solve the mystery of who was killing all of the other necromancers, if they just sort of shrugged and said, oh, well, we'll figure that out in the next book. But I think that they wrapped up enough that I thought it was a satisfying ending.
Yeah, I think this book could stand on its own, you know, if you don't mm-hmm. read the sequel.
Yes, exactly. I think that the implication is there that Gideon might actually be kind of unkillable. She's super strong. She's amazingly good with sword fighting. There were some points where she literally just says, and then I died, and then wakes up in the next one just like, oh, I didn't really die. And, you know, at the time I just dismissed it as, oh, okay, that's sort of, you know, Gideon talks with a lot of hyperbole. And so I didn't really think much of it, but I was online and looking at people's comments, and they pointed out, oh, it could be that she was actually dying and coming back repeatedly, that she is actually immortal. It's like, which,
live, die, repeat.
Except she's not exactly repeating, but she's just sort of like Captain Jack. She sort of like can sort of revive and doesn't know this about herself.
Well, they did mention that section about her name being in that old tome, and then they said, but don't tell anybody, don't tell anybody, and let's not talk about it ever again until the next book, I guess.
Yeah, and she also has, like, other special powers, too, right? Like, she can, you know, learn to predict where her combatants' weak points are and things like that, right?
Is she strong with the Force?
She's a necro-Jedi?
Nedi for short.
Nice. Now all I can picture in my mind is a picture of Ned Flanders as Gideon.
Oh, God.
Thanks.
Hi, diddly ho, undead. All right. So moving on to favorite scenes.
Like I said earlier, I really like the intro. I think it really sets the tone for a lot of the book and gets you to really know how Gideon's going to operate in this universe. And it sets the pace as well. So that's probably my favorite scene.
Yeah, I mean, it combines dueling. It took me a little while, actually, to figure out what had actually happened. Harrow had figured out that Gideon was going to catch a shuttle and had actually dug down and planted skeletons to attack her under the ground the night before.
Because she had nothing else to do.
Is this like Escape from Gilligan's Island or something?
Gideon's Island, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Sit well, back first, in your hero tale.
She took her gloves off, and Gideon said, oh, and then I realized what had happened, and that, you know, that her hands were so badly scratched, and I thought she'd put cuts in her hands and hidden fragments of bone in there, was what I had misunderstood to happen the first time. And then afterwards I understood, oh no, she actually, you know, knew what the field of battle was going to be and dug down and buried skeletons to call up to attack.
Yeah, the skeleton magic was actually, you know, rolling back like a, you know, couple of minutes, right? The skeleton magic system thing was kind of interesting, right? They had different ways of animating different skeletons, and, you know, some people were obviously better at it than others.
There was a certain programming aspect to it that I liked.
Yeah, especially the ones where, you know, they had like sort of fine motor control, like they had the ability to like serve oatmeal versus just, you know, wade forward into battle and become fodder. No.
Right. Yes. And each of the houses had, like, you know, bone magic versus it seemed like flesh and other necromantic skills. I think I liked essentially the dungeon crawl scenes where they were like trying to get into the rooms to get the tomes out and, you know, to get the keys out and stuff. That part I enjoyed, and probably the final combat, even though I got lost halfway through about what actually was attacking them, some giant bone construct or something. But I think I like some of that stuff. You kind of saw something like that maybe coming, but the fact that, you know, she's like, hey, well, in order to win, you have to become a lictor. So here you go. Let me just cut my own throat, Dibbler. And like,
okay.
Yeah. Steven, did you have a favorite scene?
Yes, one of the initial puzzle sequences where Harrow has to draw from Gideon to solve this puzzle. And, you know, Dulcinea is taking care of her. And at that point, I had kind of figured out that Dulcinea kind of had to be bad. Everything she was saying to Gideon was sort of like subtly undermining, as well as being, you know, oh, Gideon, it's okay. You can let go. It's that you shouldn't have to undergo this. It's so terrible. You know, I was not completely settled on Dulcinea being like, I didn't know exactly what she was, but I knew that she was more than she seemed in that point. But it was a really vivid scene, and I thought it was well done. I also thought that the sword fighting scenes, the thing I liked about them is, now, I've done a certain amount of Renaissance fair, and I had to learn enough sword fighting to be able to sort of teach children how to do it, but I am not a particularly good rapier fighter or anything like that. And I thought that all the sword fighting scenes struck a really good balance between explaining just enough so that you could get the idea across of what was happening versus not going overboard and talking to death about exactly which kind of weapon and the bend of it and so on, which sometimes when authors go a little bit overboard on their research, they can get a little lost and just over-describe a sword fighting scene. And sometimes they can just say, and then I sorted him more better with the swording.
and I stuck him with my sword.
Yes.
Yeah. No, I think actually they did a good job of saying a rapier has the pointy bit and it's flexible, and the other, and the broadsword, you know, have a lot of mass and you could kind of cut through stuff, and you can't really use the broadsword cutting things with the rapier because it won't do anything.
Exactly.
Yeah. The two techniques are completely different, right?
It's like, let me spank you with the rapier.
Do we have any indication that Tamsin does sword play, or?
You know, my wife has also read this book and is slightly better at sword fighting than I am. She got the impression that Tamsin was probably not heavily involved in sword fighting, but I don't know anything about her biography. Tamsin, not my wife. I know a little bit about my wife's biography.
So you were mentioning also that at some point you started getting the feeling that Dulcinea was, you know, possibly the antagonist in this book. I was thinking about it now, and I sort of got that feeling at some point too. I was kind of wondering if they were like the evil dungeon master, right, or the game master. Yeah.
Yeah, I got the sort of feeling that she was a little too good to be true. She was the only one in the book that did not appear to be evil, so she kind of had to be.
Yeah.
Yeah, sometimes, like, you know, the fact that you know you're reading a book can kind of interfere with... You know, because you kind of use your special monkey meta analysis on it, like, and you're like, oh, I know that because this looks good, it's probably bad, or that kind of thing.
Exactly. It's the sort of thinking that can get you into real trouble in real life. But no one would ever just make a comment like saying that since there's no evidence of something, that obviously means that there's a huge conspiracy, and that then it's obviously true.
So who was it that was constantly pushing the group to, you know, share information or share the ability to, you know, get past some of the puzzle rooms with each other, with the different families?
To be honest, I got a little bit lost in all the characters, as I said before. Yeah. So
I want to say it was Dulcinea, but maybe it was the teacher. It was Dulcinea, I think.
Yeah, that would make sense.
Yeah, but she was constantly trying to, like, you know, couch them to not share too much because, you know, you don't want, you know, one team to get ahead of the other. That's why I sort of got like the, you know, the evil game master where, you know, I want everybody to die, but.
Right. And at first she seemed to be being kind of like normally strategic and,
yeah.
But having her on the top of my suspect list didn't take away from my enjoyment of the book. In fact, I liked it a lot. All right. Let's see. Anything else we wanted to talk about? What character do you want to be, and or who would you be? I think I'd probably want to be Gideon or somebody a lot like her.
You don't want to be a lictor?
Don't you want to be a lictor too?
Wouldn't you want to be a lictor too?
Actually, I'd want to be teacher, this binding together of screaming souls that are forced into service. That sounds like a great idea.
Yeah, I just certainly don't want to be a skeleton. They seem to be rather disposable.
the teacher.
Does the teacher survive the book? I can't remember.
No.
No, I don't think so.
No, the teacher gets sort of shut down early, and that causes a lot of things to go badly.
Yeah.
So in retrospect, you know, the teacher was like a super lictor, wasn't he?
Well, he was an artifact, really. He was a whole bunch of different people. I mean, yeah, he was sort of like a lictor, but I didn't get the impression that he was like sentient in the same way. I mean, he was basically...
Maybe he's a golem or something.
So, a little bit like that.
He's like a Nedai holocron.
Yes, sure. I actually got that. It took me a little while, but yes.
I'm drawing back on your joke and adding my own.
Yes. Okay. All right. Let's see. Would this make a good role-playing game?
Well, the magic system, I could definitely see. And the setting, too, has a lot of unique elements as far as the Spaeth Goth fantasy or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, with a lack of specificity in the universe, it actually leaves a lot of room open to make this an interesting setting.
Yeah, now that I think about it even more, it's like it really is like the end of the line, you know, all the houses, you know, because you're thinking, you know, that's another kind of reason why maybe, you know, no lasers, no this or that. It's like, oh, how many people in my generation? Two.
Yeah.
You know, how many left in the other house? Zero. Like, you know, so there really aren't a lot of people left. And maybe it's just the nobles that are like that and the commoners are left. But
there's a definite feeling of a dying civilization. Yes.
A bit of a inbred emperor thing. I mean, that kind of makes sense with, you know, sort of some of the Roman references, I guess. But.
Yes. Yeah. Do you think that this is a book that has a lot of reread potential?
I think it's something that you could, you know, listen to multiple times. I mean, you know the plot, you kind of know what's coming. You'll probably pick up on more bits and pieces if you listen to it, you know, multiple times.
Yes. I got done with it a little bit early and I started the beginning again and it's just like, oh gosh, I missed that whole section. Okay, this is making more sense now.
Yeah, I usually find that's the case with me, that rereading the first hour, usually I find out that they've explained the entire book semi-subtly in the first 10 minutes of the book. And I just didn't pick up on any of it because somehow, you know, I hadn't constructed the up higher dimensional construct of the book in my head yet. So I couldn't really map it. And then when I go back, I'm like, oh, because I'm always like, God, if they had just mentioned this at the very beginning, it would have made so much more sense. And then I go back and I go, oh, they did. I guess I just didn't record it.
Well, you didn't know, I don't know if that happened. You don't know the importance of some of the elements in the beginning, right? The first time you listen to it, until you know the destination, where the book's going. You're like, oh, now I get it. Ah,
we'll leave out the spoilers, but I think Library at Mount Char was probably the utmost book of something happening that changes your whole perspective of how it works, and suddenly it's a very different book. Like halfway through, that if it wasn't intended that way, it should have been.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I really enjoyed Library at Mount Char.
Yes, and I think it was very much intended.
It's one of those surprise endings.
Exactly. And since we have now drifted off in talking about another book, I think it's time for us all to, as usual, merge together to become an all-powerful lictor. But we
all
shall
right.
return.
I want to be the head.
Is that like Voltron or whatever?
Yeah.
And now lictor. Form the face.
It would be like bones, flesh, and whatever.
Yes.
Necrotic energy.
Brain juice.
I'm quite sure that there's some sort of undead gothic version of Voltron in anime somewhere.
If there isn't, there will be now.
Exactly.
Yay.
Anyway, you can reach us on Twitter at sf3podcast.com, via mail at sf3podcast@gmail.com, iTunes at sci-fi, because we haven't changed the name there yet, possibly, and eventually on Patreon, because, I don't know, give us money.
Why not?
Why not? What do you have to lose except
it.
For money?
Send $5 to Happy Dude.
Or something.
You guys didn't get my Simpsons reference. I feel sad now.
Good.
Our work is complete.
Our work is complete. All right. Until next time, we have been
SF3. Is that the number 3 or is it spelled out?
Doesn't matter.
Three.
Yeah.
You're right. More threes in the threes that I just said.